So let me start off by welcoming everyone. This is the Local Government of the Future Subcommittee of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. It's our regular monthly meeting. I'm reminding folks that this is being recorded, as are all Zoom meetings. And if you have any questions, make sure that you're or comments, please either physically raise your hand or hit the raise hand button on your screen, and I'll recognize you. My name is Brendan Sharkey. I'm the chair of ACIR. Lyle Ray, not Wayne, but Lyle Ray, is our vice chair. And this is a general subcommittee without specific members. So all members of the public as well as ACIR are welcome to join. We do have meeting notes from our last subcommittee meeting, which are not voted on per se, but I don't know if anyone had any comments or thoughts on those meeting notes that Bruce was good enough to put together for us. Are there any thoughts about those or comments? Yeah.
They look good. Did you want a motion on that, Mr. Chairman, or just
no? I don't. I think we've resolved that we don't necessarily need.
Okay, they're vote. Meeting notes. Meeting notes. Then we won't approve them. Then that's fine.
Right.
They're fine.
Right. So if that's the case, then we'll move on to item three on our agenda. So, which is the we've resolved at our last full ACIR meeting that. We're going to devote this subcommittee to the topic that we had voted on and agreed we would pursue on the definitions and applications of home rule in Connecticut in an effort to provide the legislature with, as Steve and I described earlier today, as some kind of a white paper or presentation that we can give to them ahead of the 2022 legislative session and perhaps have an informational session with the chairs and members of the Planning and Development Committee and any others who are interested ahead of the 2022 session. And we can, I don't want to go back and through the history of why we felt this was important, except to say that there were a couple of higher profile and then a few lower profile discussions going on in the legislature over the course of this past year that seemed to confuse and blur the distinctions between what is home rule and what, frankly, is people's perception of local control. And to the extent that I think folks have misused and misapplied their understanding of the actual law on this, we felt that there was a need to clarify that. And what we also resolved at the last, it wasn't the last full committee meeting, but I think what we resolved since the full ACIR meeting earlier this month is that what we'd like to do is have a series, dedicate this meeting time in series over the next few months to explore particular aspects of this question of what are the boundaries and limits of home rule in terms of a locality's ability to control the things that they do. We had resolved, I think, at our last meeting to define it, you know, and explore very specific subject categories as case studies of the limits and capacity of local governments to do certain things and the limits on that. But that we would start first at this meeting with setting the table, so to speak, summarizing what the actual law is, what the differences are between what people's perception of home rule and local control actually means versus what the reality is in terms of statute and other things. And there's no better person I think in Connecticut to do that than our guest, Steve Mednick, who is an attorney. If you're not familiar with Steve, he's an attorney who specializes in all things municipal. He's currently rewriting, I don't know how many municipal charters as they do their charter revisions periodically. Steve is the go-to guy on this, I think, for most towns in the state. And no one knows this subject matter better than Steve, as far as I'm concerned. So we asked Steve to come and talk to us again, some of which we all know, some of which we may not know completely, as to what those legal distinctions are and what those boundaries are. Use that as a foundation for further conversation in subsequent months on specific topic areas. So with that very broad guidance, Steve, I'm wondering if you might get started and then be open to some questions from members.
Well, I'll be open to a lot of questions. When I saw the agenda that I was making a presentation, I was a little alarmed because I'm in the last stages of two charter revisions right now, and I'm trying to get two of them out today with two meetings in the next 2 days, one of my towns. But you know, the last meeting I agreed to take upon the responsibility of trying to lay out a definition of home rule for this group and for the project that this group is involved in. And when I saw the topic on the issue of the distinction between home rule and local control, I was a little perplexed. Although I do know I've had discussions with Francis Pickering about this issue very directly. But from my perspective, local control really flows from whatever the concept of home rule is that you have in your state. And, you know, if you take a look at Article 10 of home rule and then the case law that comes under it and the statutes that are established, Connecticut is, and the case law is pretty clear, a Dillon's Rule state. It's a state where all of the authority for local government flows from actions of the General Assembly. Most of those are contained in Title VII, which establishes the Home Rule Act that allows towns to create their Home Rule charters. And for those towns that do not have the Home Rule charters, establishes a series of enactments, a series of legislative enactments that creates different entities that you may want to have in your municipality if you don't have a charter. For example, recent discussion, somebody invoked the police commission section of Title VII to argue against the expansion of a police commission in one of my towns from 5 to 9 and said, well, the statute says you only have 5. And I said, well, that statute only applies in a municipality that doesn't have a charter. Most of my clients will use it as a point of reference because there's some case law under those provisions, but those provisions don't govern what you do under a home rule charter. You have the ability to create a board of commission of appropriate size under a home rule charter. So local control all emanates from there. It emanates out of Title VII. It could come out of other sections of just about every provision of the general statutes that would have impact on your ability to conduct local affairs. Examining an issue right now, one of my charter commissions, about requiring in the charter a board of education to publish curriculum, however that may be defined. And I am told by education experts that there really is no definition of curriculum in the general statutes. So the question becomes there, do you have authority under your home rule charter to direct a board of education to publish whatever curriculum might be? I think it's in the eyes of the beholder. And, you know, I think that there's an interesting battle of jurisdiction when it comes to that kind of issue. Certainly case law allows for municipalities to treat boards of education, departments of education, as a department of the city to follow the local procedures. But once you start crossing into education policy, is that something that's within the domain of the local government in your charter, direct them to do a thing in a certain way? So from my perspective, and Lyle and I were talking about this the other day, and I'm going to try to be as clear and precise as Lyle is in most of his presentations in putting together this definition of home rule. I'm not writing a treatise. I'm not writing a brief to the Supreme Court. I want to try to write something that legislators understand, that mayors understand, for select men understand, and the public understands in terms of the limits of home rule. I'll give you another example, and that is in the current charter that I'm doing in the speaker's hometown, in my town, Hamden. We're going to great pains to make some real substantial changes in the police commission of that town. And this all emanates from a national issue, an issue that impacted in the town of Hamden 2 years ago. There was a police shooting. There was great unrest. There was a lot of turbulence, a lot of legal actions, resolutions coming through the Legislative Council, police commissions, meeting, not meeting. And we decided in Hamden that we needed to move in the direction of 21st century policing principles and try to create a commission or have a commission that really is more robust and really does provide civilian oversight in the 21st century, in the direction of 21st century policing, as the Obama Commission established it. And frankly, most police organizations, including the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the major city chiefs, have all adopted as the approach we're taking. But one of the most important things that came out in that discussion 2 years ago, it's a principle that probably all of you understand. I understand, as somebody who practices in the area. I see Rich Roberts on the phone. He understands. We understand what the limits are and what the impact is with regard to a direct grants of authority, but there are also restrictions on our home rule. One of the greatest restrictions is under MIRA, under the Municipal Employee Relations Act, where the collective bargaining agreement that maybe a local legislative body will see for 30 days when they have to approve it. In a 30-day time frame, they have to approve a collective bargaining agreement. The provisions of that agreement will trump your local law. It will trump a provision of your charter, of your ordinances, etc. And a lot of people don't understand that. I stood before a crowd of 300 people to try to explain to them how our local charter had this procedure for citizen complaints, but there was a collective bargaining agreement that usurped that responsibility in the charter. So we're going to great pains in the current charter process, probably belt and suspenders so that no pants will ever drop in the town of Hamden in our charter, to make clear that people understand the limitations of the authority that we have. And particularly in the case where it's not just police contracts or fire contracts, it's all collective bargaining agreements, do have impact on local government. I remember as a brand new alder in the 1980s in New Haven, an alderman in New Haven, we had twice a week garbage collection when I was elected. By halfway through my first term, we only had once a week garbage collection, and I hadn't recalled anything coming before us, but there was a arbitrator determination on a collective bargaining agreement that granted the wish of the public works employees to have pick up garbage once a week. No legislative vote, nothing. It happened, and MIRA basically trumped the local charter. So the statement I'm going to write will not be about expansive power. It will be about constricted power and authority that local governments have that is very well defined, and that the only implied powers are those that come out of the powers that are expressly granted by the state of Connecticut. And I know that what we want to do as we go through this process is we want to examine the application of the rules in the state of Connecticut to different areas, how they impact. I know Bob Valentine raised the issue about ordinances. I think I just gave an example of how an ordinance could be thwarted by a state statute. Talk about the relationship with the Board of Education and finances. But I also think one of the most important areas, and I've had long talks with Joe DeLong about this over the years, is the impact of MIRA on local government and local government policy, because of the strength of that law that applies there. The other issue is NLC, and I'll send the report to the speaker. I think they did a report on principles of home rule for the 21st century back in 2020, last year. It's a national report, and so a lot of it won't be relevant to what we're doing in Connecticut, but they have an interesting breakdown where they break down the concept of home rule between home rule and states that have Dillon's case, as if that is not part of home rule. I've always thought about the distinction, and if Rich is on the line, he might have some thoughts on this as well. When I've argued cases, it's the difference between constitutional home rule and legislative home rule. In Connecticut, we have a constitutional principle, but it basically establishes legislative ascendancy, legislative dominance in the area of home rule. They look at it a little differently, and they call Connecticut a home rule slash Dillon's rule state. And I be curious, I'm going to do a little study on that and see if that helps me at all. But that's another problem, is the legislature is problematic. And my objective is to try to keep it as simple as possible and, write a definition that Lieutenant Columbo would understand. I think that's basically what I'm going to try to do. If the young people don't know who Lieutenant Columbo is, look it up. That's all I have this morning, and I promise that I will try to put some pen to paper. I'm going to be down two charters in the next couple of weeks, and I should be up for air to be able to sit down and try to work on this. And I may, don't be surprised if some of you hear from me as I try to go through this process and pick your brains. And if anybody has any thoughts, feel free to send them on to me as well.
Thanks, Steve. Can you hang on for a couple minutes if there were some questions?
Oh, I'm more than happy. No, I kind of reserved to about 11:15. If that's
great. Okay, great. Great. Are there some questions that we might want to be, or comments that we might want to be presenting to Steve or to the group that folks are thinking about? I know the topics that we discussed as the, practical applications of that baseline understanding have been set. But I think Steve's comment about MIRA, I mean, that's something we didn't even discuss amongst ourselves that right. I think is really relevant and I think is really, is something that I don't think we've even broached yet. But Lyle?
Just a quick observation. Thank you, Steve, for all this. My first class in college was political science with a constitutional lawyer, so I'm kind of scarred for life with this stuff. One suggestion would be a glossary, not a relitigation of the whole issue. I think people get confused about local control, et cetera, et cetera. But I think a glossary of key terms would be very helpful for lay people, because I think people don't use the words the way they ought to. So that's just one thought. And then the other one, I think, is for this committee is to apply some of these aspects to actually emerging issues. We are, for example, a couple of controversial things right now is the juvenile crime auto theft burst in some communities in the suburbs and so forth. The question of how we approach that is very much an intergovernmental challenge. You've got state's attorneys, you've got judges, you've got local police, you've got, state agencies and so on. But again, I think this is more of a note to us. When we get to this, I think we need to apply the principles to a real issue at hand, which is very important. And I think we're in the midst of a solid waste issue right now in the region. Mayor LeClaire and I are pulling our hair out on this. You know, the question is, clear responsibilities between state, regional, and local is very important on policy issues. I think that's sort of the issue. Someone needs to be on first. So I guess two suggestions. One is a glossary, and then one is to take real examples with sort of who's in the lead, follower, get out of the way mode on some of these issues. And again, it may vary. And again, the final point I'd make that I like about this, since I was scarred for life by a Polish constitutional lawyer, is the dynamic nature of American federalism, which is, if you're not doing your job at the federal or state level, a mayor will call you on it and run a campaign. And I remember coming to Sausalito, California, and had a big sign out saying, "Welcome to Sausalito, a nuclear-free zone." So they declared themselves a nuclear-free zone. So anyway, those are just a few observations, but thanks for your comments,
Steve. Yeah, I have two responses to you. One is the other issue that I've been dealing with on a local level, and I don't know if Rich or anybody else on the phone has had this issue. Last summer, the legislature approved the Civilian Review Board authority, and pretty broad. I mean, they granted subpoena authority to these boards, and they gave local bodies complete authority to establish their scope. Nothing in it on scope. You create your own scope. That's fine, except if you create scope that you want to look into police discipline, and you decide you want to go into the world of police discipline, if you ignore the fact that there's a collective bargaining agreement that deals with discipline, you can issue all the subpoenas you want, but they're going to be quashed every day of the week. And sometimes, so the legislature, sometimes, I say this respectfully to the former speaker and other people who are related to legislators and know legislators, as I do, they sometimes don't think these things through. And I think that that's a major concern as well as we do this. And one of the other observations I have, and I've talked to Brendan about this, to the chairman about this, is I think as part of this project, I think we need to bring attention to the legislature, to the provisions that I alluded to a moment ago, what I call the town provisions of Title VII. We need to somehow segregate them into the point where people understand what they are and what their purpose is. If you just look at Title VII, it's just not as clear as it could be. And I think that is something that we should aspire to do.
I was joking with Steve when he suggested that to me, that, you know, if we make a presentation to the Planning and Development Committee on the outcome of this study over time, and then as one of our recommendations, propose a rewrite of section of Title VII. The problem with that is that the committee will then turn around and say, "Okay, ACIR, why don't you rewrite Title VII?" So be careful what you wish for there. But yeah, totally agree.
Can I just add one thing to this, which is, you know, law is accretive, you know, and legislation is accretive, where you keep adding bits and pieces to things, where it eventually turns into a, you know, 73-room house where the plumbing doesn't work, barnacled up. And I think part of this, I mean, as much as they hate it, is occasional, and I'm not suggesting we're there yet, is recodification of some of this stuff. In other words, you clean up an area of law and sort of start from, you know, scrub it down and redo it. Now, it's about as much fun as filing. I understand this is, you know, not the exciting part of drafting or of a law, but many, many, many things probably need a good scrub. And we're an old state, so we've been around for 300 plus years. So there's a lot of stuff with barnacles on it that could probably be scrubbed. And I think that accretive aspect, you know, has its pluses and minuses. And to Steve's point, I think the other thing is, you almost always want to do a cross tab. You know, here's what this law says, and here's the other effective statutes related to this topic or practices in terms of collective bargaining or whatever. It's always in a context. There's a matrix behind all this stuff. Nothing is really free form starting from scratch. But again, not to preclude or not to prejudge this, but there may be a point for you know, recodification of some aspects of law over time. I remember once I was at a seminar in London, and they were talking about intellectual property in the 21st century, and he said, technology is the level of USS Enterprise beaming things up and down, and the law is that you stole my sheep, I want it back. And he said, you know, we need to sort of harmonize those two things a little bit more on intellectual property law and the technology. So anyway, just another comment, but I appreciate it.
Thanks. For members, I know we've got Steve for a limited period of time. So Bob, I saw.
Just to Lyle's point, I think it would be important. Steve, if you could just tie into that Section 8 in land use laws, because that certainly is very topical right now and used with my colleagues in talking about the municipality's ability to be able to regulate, in this case, from the past session, affordable housing and how you define those things and what you can and cannot do, and the whole proposition of having to create housing plan, affordable housing plans and whatnot, and how that works. But so that's a very heated debate within small towns.
Yep.
And that understanding really needs to be brought forward. Thank you.
Understood. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. John, did you have a question?
I pretty much got discussed was more on the structure or the lack thereof in Title VII. And I guess I think the need to perhaps, rake through the other titles, because, you know, there's examples where, you know, a municipal restriction or power is in some other section of the statutes and it goes unnoticed. And just as an example that happens out here a lot, which is pretty simple, is to deal with zoning and agriculture, where whatever it is in Title I, we have a state definition of agriculture, 1-1Q. And folks don't, it happens a lot where they don't realize, well, there's actually a state definition of agriculture, but the last line of that enables a town to define agriculture. For zoning purposes, but you won't find that anywhere in, you know, in the zoning statute. So, I mean, that's a small example, and I think hopefully they have guidance that helps them on that, and they come up with their own definition an awful lot and causes some issues from town to town. But I think that those restrictions or authorities for towns do appear in any number of other places in the statutes, and not knowing where those are or not being familiar with, you think you have this authority under Title VII, but there's a restriction in some other title. And
I came across, I'm trying to remember what it was, but Title IX, which is the elections.
Yeah.
Regulation of elections. There are municipal structural issues addressed in Title IX. Which I was not aware of until I tripped across recently on some matter. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, as I've said to the speaker, it's the Uber charter revision for guys like myself to go in there and try to clean up the municipal statutes. And they're not just in Title VII. You're absolutely right.
I think the non-charter towns, the 60 or so towns,
they're 60.
Particularly confusing. I think it's 60. Maybe it's a little less. I think it's 109 that have a charter, perhaps, and something like that. But most of mine do not have a charter. So
yeah, and they're dependent on those statutes, and that's their life.
And with the rapid turnover in chief elected official, and also the sort of the temptation to save money and not consult with council and do it on their own, that gets them in a little bit of trouble occasionally.
Right. Yeah. All right. Thanks, John. Francis, you have your hand raised.
Yes. Thank you, Brendan. I do wonder if Title VII were simplified and modernized, whether there would be less incentive for municipalities to create their own charter. Their own charter may also be just in part a reaction to the complexity of statute right now. On the points that were raised about how statutes affecting municipalities are interwoven throughout all the different chapters, we for a couple of years have suggested that there be a municipal master fee schedule that municipalities could set, because the fees a municipality can charge in many cases are set in statute, but they're not set in one master place where you can see them. It's really digging through the statutes to find out what they are. And even between various municipalities, they have different understandings of whether they can add a municipal surcharge to those fees. So there's just a lot of, there's a lack of understanding about things as simple as what can we charge for a service or for a permit. On a maybe related note, we've been looking at Public Act 2129, which gives municipalities new authority in the area of zoning, specifically sustainability and water protection. And we've been looking at all of our peer states in New England. All of the states in New England but Connecticut have a much stronger state framework for water protection. Many of them have state set setbacks and development restrictions. And Connecticut is almost entirely pushed down onto the municipalities, and no two towns regulate surface water bodies the same as any other town in the state, which is a really irrational approach, given that it doesn't really matter what side of the town you are on a tributary, you're in the the left side or the right side, your runoff is still running into that tributary and ultimately the Long Island Sound. So while the towns do appreciate local control, sometimes the state perhaps does over-delegate, or over-delegates. If not over-delegate, it provides too little guidance in terms of what the ultimate policy objective is.
Interesting.
So, that is interesting, yeah.
So if you permit me to kind of riff off that, Francis, then, and I should know the answer to this question, but in the absence of a charter, I'm fascinated by the notion that in other states, the zoning can be dictated, including things like setbacks, can be established by the state or by state statute. So I should know, as I say, I should know the answer to this question, but how do local governments adopt zoning regulations for themselves in the absence of a charter? They've got the ability to do it, but how do they do it if it's not derived through a charter? Do you follow what I'm asking?
Yes, Steve could probably answer that better than I can.
Yeah,
you can deal with it. There are vehicles under Title VIII where you can create those entities. I'd have to, I'm not a land use expert, but there are statutes that allow for the creation of those entities. And if you don't have a charter, you just create it by ordinance.
If I could, essentially, you create through Title VIII planning and zoning commission, either separate commissions or one commission. And they have the authority through the process of creating regulation and public hearing to adopt items such as setbacks and other rules that dictate how a municipality develops.
So, I'm a land use attorney by trade. I feel kind of stupid for asking the question, but it is kind of interesting that power and authority in terms of quote unquote local control is derived from Title VII, right? There is direct provision in other parts of the statutes that enable municipalities to do certain things.
Exactly.
And that's where Title VIII gets very confusing for people, because the Planning and Zoning Commission has some broad latitude. You take setbacks, for instance, and to set setback regulation for varying zones within a municipality, And that's open to the decision of a planning and zoning commission.
Right.
Zoning commission.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what is particularly strange is that, you know, the Connecticut, like all other states, is required to implement the Clean Water Act, but much of that implementation actually is carried out at the local level, although that is rarely, if ever, discussed or understood by local commissions. So if you look at how we handle, you know, yes, there are inland wetlands commissions that have an upland review area, but if we look at how we actually handle development in floodplains and along riverbanks, it varies dramatically from town to town, even on the same tributary. There's really no rhyme or reason to it. And that is, you know, yes, it is local control and arguably home rule, but is it even rational?
Yeah.
Yeah. Aquifer protection areas as well, to Francis's point.
Yeah, right. Well,
most of them are following, common guidance given in terms of aquifer control, which the level A aquifers is under state set of state rules, but there's locally identified aquifers. I know our zoning boards have done that and done overlays to protect those resources. You have stream channel encroachment areas that they'll also take into consideration, floodplains. That's a common element of most zoning statutes, and they're pretty much the same from town to town.
No, actually, John, they actually aren't. That's what we found. We're about to release a report on that. There's vast difference in them and what is regulated, how it's regulated. It's really quite eye-opening. So I'm happy to share that, the subcommittee and ACIR, because we did not expect to find night and day differences in the regulation between towns on this.
Interesting. Well, land use generally is one of the topics that we had identified as a practical application for the study. So maybe that's the topic for next month. Margaret, did you have a...
I think that's, you know, Francis is hitting it right on the nail on the head. But also, I think the basic issue that Steve brought up in the beginning about union contracts, that's very, and police, that's something that even in the town of Weston, it's a big issue now, which doesn't have much of anything going on one way or the other. And so that is the critical thing. What is, you know, where do we, you know, define, you know, you can talk a good talk about having, you know, civilian this and that, but then there's a union contract. So I think that's important. I learned something today. Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure. We're going through a process right now, kind of a reverse engineering process, so much for home rule. What are we doing? We're looking at our charter and the disciplinary process that was created in the charter, and the speaker can correct me if I'm wrong, is I think the original charter for Hamden was 1966, and then they did a big revision in 84, and then I did a revision 10 years ago. There's a disciplinary process for police in that contract. It doesn't exist. It's on paper. It's in our constitution. It's in our charter. And so we're reverse engineering it. What are we doing? Not coming up with the disciplinary system that we think is the right disciplinary system, but we wanted to at least have a disciplinary system laid out in the charter that corresponded with the collective bargaining agreement. And so the new starting point in the charter provision on that subject area is to try to basically mimic what is there with one addition. We are adding a civilian appeal. Right now, under the collective bargaining agreement, civilians can bring complaints, but once the chief acts on it, it's over. Whereas a police officer has the ability to appeal to the police commission. We want to create an appeal to the police commission by a civilian. But we've had to make it clear, because we want to avoid an unfair labor practice, that it doesn't take effect unless there's a change in law or a change in the collective bargaining agreement, et cetera. And so one of the fixes for something like that would be to have a uniform system, a state statute that governs police discipline, so that every police commission and police chief in the state would be operating under the same rules, as opposed to 150 different rules, or whatever number of municipalities have police departments. And as opposed to having to reverse engineer your home rule document to meet something that was created under MIRA.
Right. I'm watching the clock, Steve, for your sake. But
that's Rick, all right. I think there's some other questions. I'll stay.
Yeah, Rick, you were.
I'll do it super quick, I promise. Steve, you mentioned MIRA a little while ago. Are there really compelling examples of the state invoking its authority to set policy or enact a law which covered every city and town in the state in the interest of all the people in the state of Connecticut, where it's really obvious that it needed to invoke that authority?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I mean, the example I just gave of police discipline may be an example. If you read the Hearst newspaper series on police discipline, I mean, we went through, and Rich is on the call, we just went through the executive orders and in the past year where the governor clearly asserted, and I see Secretary Heft is on the call as well, the asserted statewide jurisdiction to have statewide standards. And that's an extreme example of it. But perhaps we've learned some things from that. I mean, or maybe we haven't. If you look at the new statute dealing with meetings, which the subcommittee is going to be focusing on for the next session of the legislature, we found that we didn't learn so much. In fact, the executive orders were in some way superior to the statute that passed. But I've been openly advocating for police disciplinary standards. Take it out of the collective bargaining process. Create a uniform standard throughout the state so that when police officers are retiring from one department, want to go to another department, the rules are uniform. Everybody understands what everybody's background is. But there are areas where that would be helpful to have that occur.
Thank you. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Other questions while we have Steve here? All right.
Well, thank you.
Good luck with you.
Yeah.
Good luck with your charters.
Yeah, well, you're a taxpayer in one of those towns. We'll need it.
No, I'm not. Actually, I don't live in Hamden anymore. So.
Oh, there you go. Well, good for you. So you don't have to worry about it. I do live in Hamden, so I have to.
I'm still an employee, but not a.
Yeah, I got you. All right, guys. A nice thing, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, bye-bye.
So to the extent that that sort of sets a baseline for us, I think what Steve was offering to do was to put together his one- or two-pager summary of the distinctions, at the broad level, along the lines of what Lyle, I think, had originally suggested was a basic outline and summary. So we'll have that and we'll be able to accumulate that, I think, and add to that as we go. So the question I guess I would then raise with the group is what do we want to, what's the sequence of additional topics that we want to pursue in the coming months? We've identified already land use issues, which we discussed today, shared services, limitations and possibilities, town ordinances, as far as what is their capacity. I think that was Bob's suggestion, education and finances. These are kind of broad topics. I also think that Steve raised this other question about bargaining units and MIRA and the extent to which that can also limit a town's ability to exercise what other authority it already has under the statute. So is there...
At the risk of getting into a fist fight, I wonder if we want to consider a codification of some things. Many states have a state code on what you can charge fees for and the calculation method for fee collection. Many states, for example, allow you to recoup your costs, but not to make a profit, quote unquote. Okay, but that's just a thought.
Yeah. That might
I would second, this is Francis, I would second Lyle's thought. We have pulled together for our region a master fee schedule for all municipalities, and it has really been a nightmare doing this because there's, with the exception of one town where in the state, the town of Berlin, no municipality keeps an eternal master fee schedule. For all that we talk about our over-reliance in the property tax, I would expect us to act more strategically with response to fees because they really are user fees. They allow us to unweight the property tax. And nobody seems to do that. So a move towards a more regular setting, reporting of fees at the state level might also encourage municipalities to do the same thing and approach their fee structures, create fee structures and approach them more strategically.
Thanks for that. I the only concern that I have is that I don't think the purpose of this effort is to necessarily solve every problem. I think it's more to lay out the framework for what the boundaries are in terms, in the context of what can towns do, what can't they do. And so, you know,
agreed.
So I do know that we had as a topic the question generally of finances. You know, what are the boundaries of a municipality's ability to control their own finances? And I think that might fall into your suggestion, Francis, might be to fall into that category as far as fees for services versus taxes versus...
Yes, I would not expect us to try to inventory all the fees charged by all departments and all town halls in the state. But, you know, if we did mention, you know, perhaps in the future, the state, the legislature should consider pulling fees out of statute and put them into a separate document. And if we also clarify that municipalities do have power to set certain fees, which they may not understand right now, that might be a positive step and not take, you know, too much work from us.
Right, right, right. Okay, so yeah, so I mean that's a topic that I think makes sense. And again, I think it falls under that umbrella of municipal finance. We should probably find people a lot smarter than me, maybe marginally smarter than the rest of you, on the financial side of this. Rick, I don't know if you've got or who's got some resources that might be able to help us with that? I don't know. Martin, is that something OPM might have? Or would CCM have some folks who've got some expertise on that as a topic area?
Well, I would think maybe I'm thinking maybe GFOA, government finance officers, might be an avenue, or CCM cost, you know, if they've got something on municipal finance side of it. We've got a municipal finance division, but it's basically just collecting budget data, you know, and analyzing stuff. It's not really going through, you know, municipal finance per se.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And Brendan, from CCM's perspective, I mean, this is important work. I think we'd like to be helpful if we can. It would also be good, though, to understand more about what this would entail. And maybe we could start with a conversation with a group of people to understand what the work will really entail.
Yeah, well, right. I think between now and our next meeting, maybe, Rick, we can do that. I think Martin's suggestion might be to get the Steve Mednick of the CFOA, you know, who can speak extemporaneously about the limitation. But the point is to kind of understand. I think folks had previously expressed an interest in understanding what limitations are placed on a municipality's ability to raise revenue.
Right.
Right. So we don't allow municipalities to have income taxes. Why is that? Well, you know, where is that in the statute? That kind of thing. Again, broad level, but again, to be part of a primer for kind of basic understanding of what we have set up in Connecticut, identifying problems as we come across them, but including Francis's about fees and fee schedules. So maybe it's a question of reaching out to someone at CFOA who may be able to kind of give us that sort of broad overview of what those limitations are.
Yeah, just to add to Martin's point, either GFOA or also NCSL, the fee setting by locals is a national issue. And as I say, many states set out a statutory framework of what you can collect fees for and the recoupment calculations and how you can recoup them. In other words, what's an allowable overhead expense, et cetera, so that, you know, you have frameworks. And I can certainly plug that into Martin or Bruce. They exist. But I think part of this is the lack of clarity where everybody's doing their own thing. And again, many states require that you demonstrate that you're recovering costs, not that you can't make a profit. You can't soak people for building permits, for example, but you could fully recover the costs of inspections and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I would suggest NCSL as well as GFOA. That would be another prospect to get information.
I think two things with that. We have to always keep in mind the charter and the non-charter towns, and because it's slightly different there. And also, we're doing this study to try to sort of set the baseline or the understanding of home rule within the state. The more we start looking at other states and all, are we crossing into, we're going to make policy suggestions to change the law. And I think that's perhaps a legitimate, but a slightly different animal as this thing may evolve, and that may well be. But I know for instance, with the non-charter towns, I have towns where you look at the fees that can be charged under zoning or subdivision, and there's limits on that. But towns will then set up under Title VII a fee structure that runs that out. So I think we need to look at first and foremost is what can and can't be done as a charter or non-charter town. And then perhaps we can make recommendations for, if we choose to, for changes, looking at what they may do in Wisconsin or some other place. But
John, you're kind of wandering.
I don't really want to confuse it too much.
You're kind of wandering into that. I think you're kind of wandering into that area where we're actually going to be, you know, I don't think the purpose, again, is to try to make recommendations for change. I think it's really just to define.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, what the current reality is so that people, you know, can understand what their limitations are. Right. I get nervous about making recommendations because I don't, you know, I think that's beyond the scope of what we're doing here. I think it's more of an educational exercise as opposed to but in any case, it's a point well taken. The difference between charter and non-charter communities is going to be vast. Margaret?
Yeah, I was going to second what John was saying, because that seems to me, if there are 169 towns, how can possibly have 169 of anything within a little state like Connecticut? And then if you see which ones have this kind and which ones have that kind, that's your first thing. And you move along to the next definition of what is this and what is that. People really have been so confused. Certainly, they hadn't thought about it in years, but certainly last year it was so confusing. I think that our responsibility is to try and straighten them out. Just a thought.
Yeah, right. So are we in agreement then that maybe the topic for next month should be on this question of finances, and then, you know, bring in someone like a Steve Mednick who can kind of give us some of the bare bones of this and the outline of what's the statute allows and what it doesn't, and then, you know, be able to put together a one or two pages on what the current state of play is with regard to statutes and what the differences are. Does that make sense?
Yes. Brendan, would it be helpful if I sent out, this is Francis again, to the subcommittee, our kind of a regional fee structure so everybody can see how complicated this is and how every town is doing something different?
Sure. Yeah. I'm sure that's fine. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I don't know if anyone has a preference for any of the other topic areas that we will ultimately get to, but for the next meeting, I just want to set a direction. So we've got some work to do between now and then to get it set up and then have a substantive discussion next month. So if there's no objection to that, I think that's the direction we'll take. Okay, great. Thanks. Martin, if you've got somebody in particular at GFOA who I'm not as familiar with that group, so I don't really know the players.
Yeah, I'll do some research and get it from the finance side because they deal with them more, but I can definitely get a contact for us. So
okay, that'd be great. That'd be great.
Yep.
All right. Terrific. Okay, well, that's our agenda for today. And unless anyone has any additional comments, I think I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved, Francis.
Second by Lyle, right? Second
by Lyle, thank you. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
We've got a meeting coming up of the full ACIR next week from Friday. So if there's any other comment before then, obviously feel free to reach out. One of the other things I'm thinking about, and I don't have an answer to this myself, but the LOB is open, at least at the first floor. It is available for presumably for meetings. I was going to check in with Jim Tamburo to kind of see what those protocols are for the building. And we'll talk about it at the next meeting, but be thinking about whether or not we want to be doing hybrid. Do we like a Zoom format? I kind of like the Zoom format myself, but do we want to start getting the band back together in person, or are we good with keeping things the way they are? I don't have a preference either way, but just be mindful of that. I think we should have that as a topic for discussion at the August meeting.
Mr. Chair, just a heads up, I will be missing the next full ACIR meeting. I got a medical appointment that landed on it. I can't change. So,
okay.
Apologies in advance.
Well, weigh in. Weigh in on this topic before.
Well, just as a point, I have scars from the codification of fees. When I used to have a real job as a county manager, we basically tried to do fees. And the legislature then came and put in place a framework for what you could charge fees for and a methodology, but they did it. We were halfway through our process. So it wasn't timely, but it's actually quite handy. Right. And the point is, in terms of revenue diversification, one of the first things to do is charge fees for everything you can to the max that's legal. And particularly when they're business related fees. And so we looked at, all of business service fees that we made sure that we fully recovered, but just FYI, but I apologize. I can't make the next meeting and I'll certainly weigh in and happy to chat in advance.
Yeah. Yeah. I meant specifically on that question of in-person versus.
We're facing the same thing. The hardest thing Krog is now piloting, as Mayor LeClaire knows, we're going to be piloting a hybrid. It's easier to do either Zoom or in person. What's tricky is to do the mix. That's the hard part. So that's the hard part. So
well, hence our other obligation for study purposes.
Thank you.
And if I could just mention, I do think we lose an important component just doing hybrid, because there's that opportunity before and after the meeting to discuss. Yep. And build coalitions for things. And that I do very much miss from having going out to Hartford and been able to do that. And we don't get as much of that on hybrids. It's just a thought.
Yeah.
Well, when before COVID, I spent, a third of my time in the car.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's that.
The other side.
Yeah.
Or more.
The other side. Although sometimes that downtime is good.
In January, less so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, to be discussed at our next meeting. Nope. So,
Sounds good.
Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
Ciao.
Thanks.